tape is number 403, dated August 24th, 1979, side 2. It's Mae Russell from Carmel. I don't want to lose track of the very important Howard Hughes. He had moved out to Hollywood in 1926 and produced Hell's Angels and established his headquarters at Lockheed Airport to build fast planes for the government. And by 1930, he was building airplanes. This is the period where we were rearming Germany and Italy and France, getting ready for World War II. He bought an amphibian plane that he worked on and gave up the movie business, not to resume it again until 1939, from 32 to 39. In 1934, he visited the Hughes Tool Company in Houston, Texas, for 5 days, and in the 30 years that it was taken over by Noah Dietrich, helping Howard, in quotes, helping Howard maintain the tool bit company, they still had the total monopoly on this tool bit. He had only been there on 5 occasions. That was in 1934. And in 1934, the Hughes Aircraft was formed in Santa Monica, California. So he was working with Lockheed, the Hughes Aircraft. And Noah Dietrich moved away from Howard to Houston, Texas in 1936. Howard remained in Hollywood with the Starlets and the Hughes Aircraft Factory in 36. In 1936, Howard was in a car accident. He killed a person by the name of Gabe Meyer, and fingerprints were taken by the Los Angeles Police Department but weren't used to identify the corpse when it was cashed in Houston, Texas, and later, much later, in 1976. In 1938, Howard was an American hero. He set the world flight record for around the world in 91 hours and 14 minutes. The Lockheed plane was built to his specifications. And up to that time, until he was drugged and taken control of and literally kidnapped, he was an extrovert. He had a ticker tape parade in New York. And he, as I say, he had a lot of women and starlets and company around him. He was an American hero and active with Jane Russell, Billy Dove, Faith Thalmerick, Jean Peters, Ida Lupino, Elizabeth Taylor, Ginger Rogers, Terry Moore, Bette Davis, Katharine Hepburn, and many, many more. He had a lot of friends, and he started getting political in the 1940s. He was making political contributions of $100,000 to $400,000, but I don't want to jump ahead. I want to describe a section. It's called Glimpses of World History by Mr. Nehru. This book came out in 1942, and it's describing the time period that we're in 1937. It's called The World in Conflict, and it said there was a kind of fascist international that had grown up, which not only carries an open, though undeclared war, but is intriguing in various countries and fomenting trouble to give it an opportunity to intervene. There is an open glorification of war and violence, false propaganda on an unprecedented scale. Under cover of the slogan of anti-communism, it advances its imperialist designs. In the United States of America, there have been Nazi conspiracies and trials. In France, in 1937, a conspiracy against the Republic was discovered. It was organized by the Cagoulards, the Hooded Men, as they were called, aided and supplied with arms from Germany and Italy. And it goes into the bombings and the murders that were committed by these men in England. Influential British foreign policy was made in a fascist direction. By 1937, the handwriting was on the walls for the international fascism that was to take place. In 35, there was the invasion of Abyssinia. In 36, Spain was attacked. In 37, China was invaded. In 38, Austria was invaded by the Nazis, and the world was going crazy with this fascism and horror. This book describes the takeover of Germany and Italy, and in 1937, the Cagoulards in France. France was completely sabotaged from the inside and was ready to collapse and be German. And later, it was Charles Lindbergh, who said, "Why don't you give up England and become German?" That was supposed to be something really beautiful. In 1937, the Germans were staking out Antarctica and set aside 600,000 square miles, and 5 years from that time, Germans would be moving there down to South America, Argentina, and Antarctica. Adolf Hitler had a strong interest in Antarctica. Later, the astronauts would have and would spend a lot of time down there. This was a place that fascinated the Germans and was used by Germans. The Washington Post in 1974 had an article about General Motor and Ford Motor Company building up Germany just prior to World War II and up to the point where the hostilities really got heavy, and then getting reparations afterwards. They converted all of their factories to war. They said the General Motors and Exxon subsidiaries, at the request of Nazi officials, joined the German chemists, and they supplied plants and mechanisms for the German armies and leaded fuel. And in 1938, General Motors chief for overseas operation was awarded the War Order of the German Eagle, first class, by Adolf Hitler, and they agreed to build their truck facility at Brandenburg, and they were sending weapons and building weapons throughout the war for the Wehrmacht and using the General Motors plants for the Luftwaffe, building up the German army. When the war was over, these same people got a lot of money in reparations. They got $33 million in cash. General Motors got $33 million in cash and credits from the United States for damages inflicted on their planes in the General Motors factories in Germany that they were making for Nazi Germany. And also ITT was making airplanes for the Nazi Air Force. And when the war was over, the American taxpayers paid them money to resettle in the Bahamas because of the damage done to their factories by United States troops. If that isn't a can of worms, think that went out. In 1938, Aristotle Onassis had his oil transport ship built, and he multiplied his fortune because during World War II, the Germans wouldn't attack him, and he could take supplies and oil to Argentina and was always protected by the Germans. In 1938, a man named Herschel Grinspan killed a German, Ernest von Roth, because his parents had been deported from Germany to Poland. He was the secretary of the German embassy in Paris, and the retaliation was that famous Night of the Broken Glass, where riots broke out and stores and homes were destroyed and synagogues were destroyed and shops were looted. And November of that year, just 3 days later, 26,000 Jews were arrested and sent to concentration camps. Jewish children were expelled from all German schools, and the Aryanization was complete. It was compulsory to stop all Jewish industries, businesses, and shops. In 1938, the United States joined Interpol, that agency that was set up by the Gestapo and Meyer Heydrich, that had moved from Vienna to Germany, and J. Edgar Hoover became the vice president of Interpol in 1946 with the same Gestapo members. Heydrich was killed, but the others were still in there. Hoover was affiliated with the Nazis in Interpol since 1935 and was corresponding with them, the head of our Federal Bureau of Investigations, and, as I say, became vice president in 1946. But in 1938, the United States became active in Interpol and were still part of Interpol and sending them money and combined our police forces with them. In the book Armies of Spies by Joseph Guillaume, it describes the political climate in France, in many countries, but there's a section in France going on since 1933 and up till the fall of France, and it tells about small groups of spies that worked together and then formed armies. And they invaded various countries by the thousands and began spreading propaganda and tampering with the industries. They introduced livestock epidemics, making animals sick. They made a study of water supplies, communication, and transport systems, promoted assassinations and incidences, and were international wreckers, according to Mr. Guillaume, on a highly organized scale. And he goes into the cagoulards in France, the Hooded Ones, as the United States Klan was escalating here, and Adolf Hitler's terror was reaching its full peak in 1939. The French had been weakened to such a point that there were secret cells set up by the Nazis. They had regular monthly meetings. Their violence was planned, as I say, their explosions. In fact, there was a matter known as the Rosselli Affair, and I don't know if this is related to the John Rosselli in this country or not. He was from a rich family, a professor in Genoa, who was giving Mussolini trouble. And Fraselli was joining the anti-fascist group, and he was visiting in France, and they had him killed, and the powers that be assumed it was the Italians that were killing, but it was really that cell network of Adolf Hitler's that had spread all over Europe. And according to this book, there were 200 families in France who owned the bulk of France's wealth, and I'm sure that's true today. So by 1939, the fascists were ready for Hitler to take over the country, just as the group wanted Hitler to take over the White House in 1934 in the United States. One of the covers for the fascism was the healing offices. Actually, it was a weapons collection, and it was heralded because of their hypnotism and their healing. And I'm wondering, today with so much holistic healing and massage parlors or healing services and the travelers, various people healing, if this couldn't be a cover over. Also, there were boarding houses run by genteel elderly ladies where heavily hooded male figures would come, and those were the Cagoulards, the counterpart of the Ku Klux Klan here, the hooded ones, and they had shortwave radios and accumulated addresses, and they worked with the Italian-German weapon systems. And in this book, Guillaume describes in his secret armies who's behind this. It was an organization called the Tsar, C-S-A-R, Committee Secret d'Action Revolutionnaire, and they were responsible working with the Cagoulards in their secrecy, and they were synonymous with the Nazis in Germany, as I say, the fascists in Italy, and they followed the river and water transportations. This group, in the hooded ones, the part on the hooded ones, it tells about the Bouvier family. The Bouvier family was involved with the Tsar movement, that white Russian revolutionary extreme right-wing fascist group. The police got a lead in Africa or Morocco, and they brought back one young soldier by the name of Jean-Marie Bouvier from Paris. He was a son of a Parisian industrialist. He was serving in Africa, and he was named along with some André Huguet of murdering the Rosselli brother, that he was the part of the French Nazi fascist movement. And I wonder if Jacqueline Bouvier, she went to school at the Sorbonne in France, studied in France. She has French descendants. She was later to marry Aristotle Onassis, working with the Nazis in Germany and in Greece. And Jackie's father had an interesting background. Hugh Auchincloss, her father, was in Navy intelligence in World War II, at a time when the Navy was bringing Nazis into the United States in Project Paperclip. They had this large home and estate in McLean, Virginia. His first marriage, Hugh Auchincloss's first marriage, was to Maya de Chaprovitsky. I'll try and have space on the printed tape for you to get that down. A white Russian czarist, and these white Russian czarist teams were trained in terror that the hooded ones of the Cagoulards were, and Hugh's first marriage to her, this white Russian from the Tsar's entourage, took place at a time when he had a brokerage firm in New York, $160 million invested in a brokerage firm. This was Hugh Auchincloss, the father of stepfather of Jackie, but the Bouvier connections linked, in France at least, to the Nazis and the Cagoulards, the hooded ones. And then Mr. Auchincloss was heavily involved in counterintelligence with the white Russian community. At the time of the assassination, it turned out that George de Morenschild, the man mentioned on the tape last week, whose father was manager of the Nobel oil fields for the Nobel family in the Baku region before the Tsars were kicked out, George de Morenschild was a friend of Janet and Hugh Auchincloss. He knew them and had seen Jacqueline when she was a young girl or a young woman when he came to this country. De Morenschild had been apprehended as a Nazi spy. He worked with the FBI, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. He had known cousins who were Nazis. So in with this enigma or this mystery of Jacqueline Bouvier is the question of their links to France, to the French Nazi counterintelligence group, the rightist groups, the Bouvier connections in this country, and the Auchincloss connections to the Tsarists and the same interlocking groups. In a running commentary in a newspaper on Jacqueline's birthday, there's been a series about her, in addition to that article about the mystery of Jackie. And one edition of the Sunday paper described the situation in Dallas when John Kennedy was killed. And she was described as, this is the way the paper reads, her poise, her strength stunned the world. She didn't sleep. She never wept before the camera. She had stamina and dignity. She got up at 4 a.m. and planned every detail of the funeral to make it as close as possible to that of Abraham Lincoln. Now, Alan Dulles came to the minutes of the Warren Commissions with this. I have a story of the past assassinations, and it very closely parallels Lincoln. And one of the ways that the CIA covered up the murder of John Kennedy was to say, we can never find the answer. We've never solved the Lincoln murder. There were a lot of parallels between the Lincoln murder and the John Kennedy assassination, and she stayed up to plan the funeral to continue these parallels with the Lincoln assassination. This article describes her with a dry eye among all the people at the time of the funeral. It goes on to say, at the White House reception, she actually appeared radiant as she greeted dignitaries, smiling and shaking hands with Prince Philip of Britain, Emperor Haile Selassie, President Charles de Gaulle, and other heads of state. Later, she went upstairs to the family sitting room for John's third birthday party, and she emerged as the most admired woman on earth. Then it says, Jackie took an Adriatic cruise after Kennedy's funeral and assumed her new role as America's widowed queen. And it shows a picture of her holding hands with Aristotle Onassis, a really freaky combination. The Adriatic cruise was with Aristotle Onassis after John Kennedy was dead. I don't want to jump up to 63, but I just want to bring out, because this book goes into, in the Army of Spies, goes into the era of France in the 30s and the overthrow of the French government and the undermining of it and the role of people like persons by the name of Bouvier, wondering if they're blood relatives, even the death of a person named Rosselli, because later another Rosselli is going to be involved in the killing of a Bouvier. Are these coincidences, the links of George and Jean de Morenchild to Jackie's stepfather, the relationship of him to the white Russian czarist entourage? I don't know, but I think they should be explored. And the Bouvier family in France was working with the Nazis, with the white Russian agents, and the Bouviers have been very much part of the anti-communist operations, the Nazi Onassis connections, Jackie's background, the backgrounds of her family, and the way she met John Kennedy have to be explored really much, much deeper. And then I think that all the mysteries about Jackie will be solved. The question that I said last week was an article, Jackie's a mystery without a motive. Of course, the bottom line was a $26 million settlement with Aristotle Onassis and a lot of satisfaction and protection all down the line. And that would be motive for a lot of women for a lot less money. And particularly when politics are involved and when a man has betrayed you and taken on other women, it's a lot easier to do the job if you can fix him up with all kinds of women so you find underpants under your pillows and so forth. It's easier to get things done if they have to be done by instigating antagonisms towards that person that makes the job easier. If you understand what I'm trying to ask as a question, is it possible? Yeah, I think it's possible. Incidentally, the Cagoulards and the Tsar, the organization called Tsar, and the Rightists that were in France in 1939 had an instruction booklet on what to do in case they were ever caught murdering or bombing. And they said, what you should do is blame the communists for the violence. Leave a handbook around with instructions written by the Communist Party. This happened at the time of the SLA farce when Patty Hearst was kidnapped. They had Carlos Marighella's mini manual for urban guerrilla warfare left outside of the rooming house in Oakland when Dr. Marcus Foster was shot. Lee Harvey Oswald's Das Kapital was closely identified with him. The book that was referred to by 20 or 30 czarist Galen agents, they all had to say that he was reading Das Kapital on a coffee table. The important thing is that the handbook that was left for the Cagoulards and the Nazis, right down to the letter, was exactly what happened with other violences in this country that were to be blamed on the left. Our friend Jack Ruby is now back in Chicago. There was a murder in one of the unions, and Then the union was taken over by Paul Dorfman and Sam Giancana. Giancana later is to be involved in the John Kennedy assassination and works with the Howard Hughes, Robert Mayhew assassination teams, and then he himself was gunned down before he testified at the Senator Church Committee. 39, when Germany invaded Poland, the Council of Foreign Relations was offering their assistance and their diagnosis of society's ills to the State Department. The State Department experts could be moved aside because the Council of Foreign Relations members had studied what they wanted from each country and they were to give their advice. 1939 is the year that Howard Hughes met Charles Lindbergh. Both politically right, both heroes with ticker tape parades, flying experts. Terry Moore told me when I was in Los Angeles that the meeting was a very great historical occasion, or hysterical, and I believe she told me she was there. It was in an airplane hangar. Lindbergh came out to California, and Howard Hughes was working on a plane. And everyone was in anticipation of these two great heroes, these weirdos, finally saying hello and meeting each other because they had a lot in common, except they didn't want to acknowledge it in front of everybody. They worked with subterfuge. So Charles Lindbergh walked over to Howard Hughes, and Hughes walked over to Lindbergh, and they each said hello and parted. And that was their great meeting in 1939, the year that Germany began to occupy Czechoslovakia. Adolf Eichmann was in charge of the Prague branch of the Immigration Office. As I say, Germany invaded Poland in September of that year. A gentleman by the name of James Webb Young was in Washington, D.C. in 1939 to 1941. He was director of the Bureau of Foreign Affairs and Domestic Commerce, working for Nelson Rockefeller. He goes on to become vice president and director of J. Walter Thompson Agency, a front for the team that put Richard Nixon into the White House, and also a cover for the Central Intelligence Agency. And J. Walter Thompson's name comes out through Watergate, the tentacles, and the control of advertising and selling presidents. Young, in 1939, was working in Washington, D.C. for Nelson Rockefeller. Later in 1941, he becomes chairman of J. Walter Thompson. We find him in 1950 as a consultant to the Ford Foundation on mass communication, and it was this same man, Mr. Young, who began to supply the Elders of Prodigals of Zion, which was Hitler's great anti-Semitic paper, to the United States and to South America to begin the large hatred of Jews in Central and South America. The Ford Foundation was distributing these, and J. Walter Thompson agent was working Ford Foundation in their communications and getting this out. 1939 to 1941, Adolf Hitler was being assisted by Charles Lindbergh. In 1936 to 38, Hitler had made trips to Germany. That's when he told Britain, give up and become German. He worked with the German air officials. October the 18th, 39, he received the Service Cross of the German Eagle, presented by Hermann Göring on orders of the Fuhrer. In 1940, Tom Dewey from New York was working with Lucky Luciana, the Mafia, and the OSS that's to become later the CIA. And when Tom Dewey runs for President of the United States, his vice president is none other than Earl Warren, who later became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who covered up the Kennedy assassination. In 1940, the Germans invaded Denmark and Norway. The Polish concentration camps at Lodz were sealed off. The Warsaw Ghetto was sealed off. Interpol had moved to Berlin, and Heydrich had built Hitler's hideaway in Antarctica. By 1940, that had been arranged by Meyer Heydrich. Winston Churchill, the great buddy of Aristotle Onassis, and the gentleman who visited the yacht for his, in quotes, getaways, became Prime Minister of England in 1940. There's a book called The Ciano Diaries, which describes Italy in 1940, the relationship between Hitler and Il Duce, the attacks against England. They were both going to invade England, and Hitler was stalling, putting it off. They had a summit meeting, and they were going to have landings and conversations, and all of a sudden, there were no more invasion plans of England, and Mr. Hess had flown over to England what was described as a plane crash, and then it turned out that he was making a deal with the British to stop attacking Great Britain, that Germany was going after the Big Bear, the Soviet Union, and they decided to let up on England and direct their energies to the East. That was the message he brought, and he's the one lone war criminal in prison today, unless that's a double there, taking his place, and the Russians have insisted that he stay there because it was those meetings in England that turned the tide of the war that made the decision, we'll get off your back and we'll go after Russia. In the United States, J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, who was sympathetic to the Nazis and corresponding with them up through this period, was asked by Franklin Roosevelt in 1940, they agreed that they should check into hundreds of persons who were criticizing Charles Lindbergh, and the data of the FBI spying on newsmen, government officials, and civil rights leaders began in 1940. President Roosevelt allegedly ordered wiretaps on the telephones of his closest aides, and they wanted to know who was against the Nazi policies of our great hero, Charles Lindbergh. The Germans invaded Yugoslavia in 1941. Hitler invaded Russia in 1941, and this was a very important date. June the 13th, Hitler invaded Russia, and they tried to take Moscow. And in 1941, in December, the United States entered war. Pearl Harbor was attacked. In August of 1941, a Yugoslav named Desko Popov came to the United States to give a message to the FBI. He was involved as a counter-spy in Germany for British intelligence, and he claimed that he knew in advance that Pearl Harbor would be attacked, and J. Edgar Hoover would have nothing to do with him, and he names the place where he met J. Edgar Hoover twice. Later, Clarence Kelly in 1974 said Mr. Popov is lying, and Popov insists that he's telling the truth, and he came forward and he said that he wants to make this country immune from future mistakes by getting to the bottom of this one. If responsible people could be made to answer for this, then it wouldn't happen again. And he refers to Watergate exposing certain things. He said, I'd like the FBI to get out of its foxhole. They were so stupid during that time. Hoover wanted to protect his empire, and he didn't want anyone else getting credit for doing it. And I believe it's more sophisticated than that, but that was his explanation on why we let Pearl Harbor happen. But it was like the sinking of the Lusitania or other accidents that take place. There was a reason for us being attacked first, and then we would get into the war, other than our being the aggressor and making the war first. So J. Edgar Hoover avoided this. We had been arming Japan since the early 30s. Up to the day that war broke out, we were sending medals and stockpiles. Another important date in 1941 that went on until 1945 was the expose of Japanese germ warfare atrocities. And I really feel that to understand the present, and I'm running down this historical chronology because we can't understand today or tomorrow unless we realize how much went under, or some of the things. This, again, is a fraction of some of the things that went down. But in 1941 to 1945, during World War II, the Japanese did bacteriological warfare experiments. They escaped all prosecution because they shared their findings with the American occupation forces. The experiments were done in Manchuria from 1941 to 1945, where the scientists killed prisoners. They infected them with plague, cholera, anthrax, and typhoid. And now these people who did it hold prominent positions in the Japanese government today. The Japanese unit in the wartime was called Number 73. Before they surrendered, workers were killed in this camp, and the remains of the buildings were dynamited to conceal the activities. The researchers stayed out of the major cities. They ran death factories, like in Germany. They did the experimentation of warfare. Their headquarters were in Harbin, China, the same place where in 1930 the white Russian community was living, and many of them came to form a fascist bloc in Connecticut when they moved to the United States. They disguised themselves as a clean water epidemic prevention center, and this is what I think that germ control center in Atlanta, Georgia is, a front for future genocide and disease experiments such as the swine flu or the Legionnaire disease. Victims were vaccinated, then they were exposed to disease. At least 3,000 were put to death, and guards and doctors were recruited. Some of the best pathologists from Japan were put into this operation, They were from Kyoto University, and as I say, they have high power today in the Japanese government and worked at the Harbin Epidemic Control Center, and they used Chinese prisoners from Manchuria and other prisoners. Our time is out. Next week, I'll try to conclude as far as I could get and get back to it later, maybe some more chronology going on from 1941 until the end of World War II.